So let's turn to questions. And if you'd please introduce yourself when you ask your question, so we know where you're coming from.
Yeah, I'm Jan Bilhin, a Bible scholar.
Yeah, the Bible people scare me.
so I have some questions about the modern use of role that the prophet plays. But I wanted to make a comment about Jonah. You know, readers of Jonah or the ancient audience would have known probably that Nineveh no longer existed, that it was annihilated, wiped off the map in 611, which brings even more complexity to the story. So in the end, they are destroyed, but perhaps the prophet never sees it. And maybe that makes Jonah the target of an implied indictment. The prophet needs to be more humble.
Yeah, I mean it's hard. I haven't read everything on the book of Jonah. All of the critics. I read Jack Sasson's commentary on Jonah. I read some of the Jewish commentaries on Jonah in the Jewish biblical series. And you know, I know that the most of the dating of it is after the return, you know, from exile. So it would have been destroyed, but rhetorically it functions. They did survive for a while longer. You know, it wasn't in response to Jonah's criticism. You know, you could have what we lawyers would have called intervening causes. But you're right, it does add a tremendous layer of complexity there as well. And
you had a question too. Or was that it?
I'll just say points about ancient prophecy, and it seems like, and here I'm thinking about marginal groups, like in the Dead Sea Scrolls community.
Yeah.
You see a lot of interpretation of prophecy, at least, and very strong indictment of the wrongs of the majority community. But frequently, while the form of the indictment looks as though it's aiming to change society, the prospects of actually effecting a change are slim.
Mm-hmm.
The rhetoric then seems more intended, at least within this marginal community, to promote the values of the indictment within the community, and to kind of remind people of why they're not part of the larger community, to keep them separate, and to build up the community without necessarily changing anything outside. And I wonder if you see that kind of those kinds of roles in modern prophecy.
In modern prophecy, well, I see. I mean, one is it intend to change? Well, it certainly intends to shore up the in-group. I mean, you know, by holding them accountable to the goals that they have. But I'm not convinced that, at least in the American context, it isn't meant to kind of call people to account and have them repent and reform. The problem is, you know, in a pluralistic society, it doesn't necessarily have the effect that they want it to have. It did produce, repentance and at least some outward signs of repentance, fast days, you know, in Puritan New England. So, I mean, it had some effect.
Great. Other? Yes, Jim.
Jim Bresky from the School of Theology and Ministry. Thanks so much, Kathy. I want to turn to your chapter on the chapter 6 and 7 of the Culture Wars, where you were making the observation that, you know, people will come at abortion, you know, pretty monolithically, or torture pretty monolithically, but when it flips, they see more distinctions than you might think would be logical methodologically. And I've been struck by that myself, and I wonder if, and this is, you know, it's a hypothesis out there, I wonder if it isn't, in fact, part of the dynamic of groupthink, where you belong to one political party, and you align up pretty, pretty much in line with that, whether it be Republican or Democrat, and that seems to trump what would seem to be logical methodological positions. If you approach abortion this way, you should approach torture this way. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think you might be right. In terms of the studies have shown, I think support your view on that. it's not clear to me. I mean, that would be a, you know, a causal explanation. I suppose what somebody might say, and you do get people saying this, is, well, you know, torture isn't a fundamental issue. So you get some people saying, you know, flat out, this isn't an, you know, a fundamental issue. And so therefore we don't need, we shouldn't, you know, think in those terms, prophetic terms about it. Or, you know, the same thing, you'll say, well, abortion, there's nothing we can do anything about, tends to be the line. So we have to kind of manage it with you know, nuance and pragmatic and prudential concerns. But I think, you know, the new literature on how what really does determine how people think isn't their religious views so much as their political affiliations, I think is very disturbing and may very well be right. So I think you could be right. I'm sad about that, though.
Thank you.
Yeah, David.
Question that I had, I'm interested in, say, what you're doing here in chapters 4 and 5 about kind of the evolution of this Jeremiah, the way the prophetic denunciation comes forward. When you were talking, it reminded me a little bit of Michael Walzer, who has this concept that he calls a connected critic. Is a book called Interpretation on Social Criticism, where he goes into this, where he says that a prophet, or what he wants to call a connected critic, is somebody who is connected to the community and uses the history, the values, the normative texts of the community to stand over against the community to challenge it for what its failures are. But it keeps the connection, you know, that you're not just saying, you people over there who are completely corrupt and alien from me, it's about what we should do, because we're part of a community together. Are you saying that between that the Jeremiad or the denunciation moved from a sense of denouncing something because it isn't what we ought to do, to saying that you people over there aren't even a part of a community with me anymore, and I'm just going to stand over against you and denounce you as separate from the good people, namely us?
Yes.
I mean, is it dividing between us and them in a more radical way than Walzer's connected criticism would do?
It is, and where I saw it happening was the flip was, there was always, and I hesitate to talk about Bible scholars in front of Bible scholars, so forgive me, but, you know, what they've called the oracles against the nations, you know, the denunciation of Israel's neighbors and the sins of Israel's neighbors, which tend to result in a much more radical kind of call for destruction. You know,
okay.
Not a hoot owl, not a, you know, nothing's going to grow, you're going to, you know, there's no real possibility of reform in these verses, let's say in Jeremiah
just,
and Isaiah.
Just going to hell.
Going to hell in a handbasket.
Yeah.
And, now, where you see this in the American rhetorical tradition is that this sort of rhetoric was employed, the oracles against the nations, you can see in the 1750s, 1760s, against the French in the French and Indian War. So, you know, you've got the sermons who are being preached against the horror of Babylon. You know, the Catholic French are going to come in and, you know, they're going to kick out all the English and it's all going to be really bad. We're going to be papists again and the devil's going to take over. You know, the rhetoric is very, very horrible. So that didn't really affect the community, because this was used to rile up people who were not part of the community. The French people weren't reading really the rhetoric of the, you know, Puritan preachers. But less than 15 years later, 10 or 15 years later, you're in the middle of America's first civil war, which is the Revolutionary War, because at least 20% of, you know, of the colonists really didn't want to separate from England. And what happened then was you see a shift in the rhetoric. So the patriots in that took some of the language that had been used in the oracles against the nations against the French and refurbished it and used it against the people who were loyalists. And so what you have is this kind of shift in the tone of the rhetoric that, because they just move in that. So then the King of England become, well, why can't we stay with the King of England? Well, you've got the taxes and that. But they're just a little bit too you know, they're not going to protect the purity of the Church of England. They're going to compromise too much with those who have Romish tendencies. And so you get a much harsher rhetoric that's on both sides in the Revolutionary War. And then that carries on. So if you read the rhetoric around abolition, it isn't just we're in the same community. You've got Garrison calling the Constitution a covenant with hell. You know, I mean, really almost setting itself outside. So that's what I think happened. That was one of the moves that moved it from kind of this cozy kind of, let's all go.
Does your humility model, though, in the final part call for maintaining some kind of sense of being in the same community with the people that you're denouncing?
Yes. And what I that's okay. part of what I want to, I mean, and that's what Lincoln is for. So what I do is I look at Lincoln and two talks. I look at his Gettysburg Address, and then I look at the second inaugural. And what I argue is that actually the Gettysburg Address was flawed in some ways. I mean, sorry.
Yeah, a little note along.
That's right.
But, you know, because in a sense, he couldn't account for, you know, he was trying to hold the Union together, but he was killing to push it apart. This was a cemetery that wasn't burying the Southern dead, you know, but it was supposed to be a national cemetery. So we hadn't come to terms with the fact that the flaw was in the whole nation and that the South, especially through its economic process, the North, rather, through its economic issues, you know, actually help support slavery as well. So, but what you get by the time you get to the Gettysburg Address, not the Gettysburg Address, the second inaugural, is he's figured out a way to hold the whole country together and the whole country repenting together before God, without knowing who did what and without knowing exactly what God wanted out of this situation. So he's not a moral relativist. He went forward and fought the war. He recognized this was the best thing to do. But he also recognized that he did not have a God's eye view of what God wanted out of this situation, and held us together. So that shift was, I think, really crucial, and that's something we need to incorporate moving forward.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
Pat. Can you be, I'm Pat DeLue from the Provost Office and a medieval historian, so I'm thinking medieval examples here too. Can you be prophetic without being religious?
Yes.
Because all of the examples that we're all coming up with, Hebrew scripture, I'm thinking the Didache, but including the Puritans and including Lincoln, and certainly including Martin Luther King, all had notions in their head of norms for human behavior, but also an afterlife where you will get yours.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Can you be prophetic without those convictions? For example, the pro-choice side in 2004.
Yeah.
Many are not religious at all, I assume.
Right.
Can they be prophetic?
Well, that's a really interesting question. This book that I really got a lot out of, James Darcy's The Prophetic Tradition and Radical Rhetoric in America, basically said that the covenant, eventually it became the covenant that we were indicting against, became the Constitution. You know, that was clear. And so to the extent that you're indicting against the Constitution, you can use the prophetic forms. But what he argued, and he took the gay rights movement as an example, was that it was hard for the gay rights movement. I mean, this was written in 1990, so I actually think there's another chapter he needs to write of the book. Was hard to be prophetic because they weren't arguing for an absolute moral standard held, and so therefore they turned to more of a consumer power rhetoric rather than the rhetoric of moral indictment. And he argued that that hurt the advancement of that political movement. So, but there have been, you know, people who have used it. But the question is, how successfully can you use it and how successfully can you motivate?
And maybe you can have a certainty in human rights that is the equal of a certainty in an afterlife.
I think it's got spiritual resonances. I would say that, you know, when it's used, it always kind of, I go back to Tillich in a way. There's this sense that there's something, I'm saying this to you, a matter of ultimate concern at stake that has, you know, even if not a theistic, a kind of a resonance in the spiritual realm.
I wonder, we got a couple other questions here too, but I wonder whether or not you see things as, because you're writing a normative account of how we ought to deploy
yeah.
rhetoric in addition to looking at it historically, are there topics that are that should not be addressed from a prophetic stance, either because, I mean, you try to address the divisiveness question, but perhaps because things are not shared, views are not shared enough to make it hold, or perhaps because it's dangerous in some meaningful way, or inaccessible to moral rhetoric? Are there things that you see that don't warrant prophetic, like, you know, we wouldn't deploy prophetic witness against people who run stop signs, right? But are there big picture issues that don't, maybe. Maybe we would.
But, in Boston, maybe.
Left from the right lane is, okay. Yeah, but are there things that you think should fall outside the scope of the prophetic claims?
Well, I think that, I mean, what I say is that really to justify the use of prophetic rhetoric, and I go back to the Hebrew scriptures on this, you know, it has to be a matter of fundamental concern to the community. So the two examples were idolatry and care for the poor, you know, that, you know, say Isaiah would, you know, generally indicted on. And those were fundamental matters. So if you don't think it's a fundamental matter, what you shouldn't do it is to up the attention you get, which is a big temptation. You know, point weak, pound on pulpit. You know, I mean, you know, you can't. That was a sermon notes, I guess I heard at one point. So that you're not supposed to do. And then, you know, the fundamental matter is one thing. Implementing is something else. Where prophets tend to go wrong, I think, is that, say, take abortion. I mean, I think the question of who's a member of the community, okay, that's a fit subject for, you know, prophetic rhetoric. But then when you get to, well, what do you do about the law in a society where not everybody agrees on that? And how are we going to legislate? And, you know, what should we do? Then those implementing things are not really susceptible to prophetic rhetoric in the same way. So.
So we had Claire, and then a question here, I think, and then back in the back. So go ahead.
Hi, I'm Claire Boskin, a neighbor, just a very convenient neighbor here. Your last statement it brought me smack into the present political scene, and I wonder how you translate your understandings to what's happening in the American political scene now. For example, as pertains to health care, which is something that affects the greater good. Or other issues that you might discern as being applicable to what you're presenting today. Do you see a way to
turn the
lens on what's happening today?
I believe religious liberty is a good thing, but I believe the use of the kind of the prophetic mode of calling, you know, the contraception mandate, you know, given the, you know, a violation of religious liberty, you know, I mean, that was, in my view, kind of an inappropriate use of prophetic rhetoric. Not that religious liberty as an abstract value isn't, you know, something that's suitable for prophetic rhetoric, but, you know, how are you working out the connections between, you know, a very elaborate law that's trying to balance all sorts of things, and maybe you got that wrong, maybe you could modify it, but I would not have used, you know, the prophetic indictment of violation of religious liberty in that instance. I would save it for some of the terrible things that is going on in the Middle East, for example. So that would be one example.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anne Marie.
How do we get a prophet when we need one? I mean, I'm thinking of Obama, who came in saying we are not red state, blue state, we are one nation. The Nobel Committee seemed to think he was a prophet, but he didn't seem like the whole country wanted a prophet or was receptive to his message. His humble sounding, we are one lamentation.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, an actual true prophet, like, you know, I'm not actually, those are for God to raise. And if God, you know, raises a prophet, you know, you have to, you know, I have nothing to say to somebody other than, you know, if that's your thing. What I'm talking about here is people who are not prophets themselves who are using this form of rhetoric to advance a political agenda. And what I'm saying is don't put on the mantle of a prophet to quickly, because you can do a lot of harm when you do this. When I've given this talk to other contexts, people say, well, I can't, you know, I'm going to use prophets for the people I like, and then the people I don't like, I'm not going to give them that label, because, you know, I like, you know, the abolitionists, they're prophets, but the anti-abolitionists, not so much. Well, you... I'm talking about the type of rhetoric that's used and the structure of the rhetoric. So I'm trying not to make normative judgments about, you know, only giving the label to one person, you know, so that's what I'm trying to do.
Does crisis play a role in that?
Yeah, I mean, I think they manufacture crises, too. I mean, part of a prophet is to... You know, the way the prophetic rhetoric worked for the Puritans was, you know, if you didn't reform, God was going to punish you. You know, we didn't pray hard enough. We lost the battle. You can find them saying this, you know. We lost the battle because you didn't all repent enough.
And it's fear.
Yeah.
You're engendering fear.
Yeah.
We had a question in the back, yes.
Frank Byrne, visiting from Australia, from law school.
Great.
Hi.
Thanks, Kevin. I'm just wondering whether, like, conceding there's a place for humble prophecy in the public square, is it so much a case of either or both and, in that can you be a humble prophet unless you're part of the community, but you're engaged with others in exhausting the processes of deliberative democracy according to democratic values, that if you're not doing that, you'll be perceived not to be humble? And that it's not so much an either-or, but a both-and. And the prophecy is like the icing on the cake. And that, in a sense, the Old Testament prophets are not our model in that they were loners, whereas Martin Luther King wasn't a loner. He was a leader. And he couldn't have done that. And the prophecy wouldn't have worked but for the engagement in society with the commitment to exhausting the possibilities of deliberative democracy. And then it's
by then. I think that's an interesting point. I don't think one rhetorical form can be both and at the same time. Because I think prophecy is kind of like... prophecy is much more powerful. It's like a little bit of garlic. I mean, I can deliberate and, you know, all offer all sorts of things. But if in the middle of this I indict you for being a bad person, if I'm saying, well, you know, there's this, and by the way, you are fundamentally undermining American... I mean, the person is only going to hear that aspect. And the reasons behind it aren't going to be, you know, to function. At the same time... I think a good prophet, you know, maybe he himself isn't engaged in that, but he's networked with people who do that. Although, yeah, I'm thinking Jeremiah Wright. I mean, Jeremiah Wright, I think, was a good prophet. I mean, I think he got a bad rap, you know, when you read about, you know, when, if you go back and look at the rhetoric of his thing. And I don't know how much he was involved in democratic process. He was involved in other types of community transformation. So you have to be involved in the community, but maybe it doesn't have to be legislative process.
Yes?
Judy.
So Judy McMorrow from the law school. Just as you were describing, it made me think of a particular tiny debate in the sub-community of the public square. So I'm working on a project which seems so boring, which is, should non-lawyers be allowed to own and invest in law firms? And it would turns out you have this perfect parallel, because there was this prophetic rhetoric of, outside of a religious sphere, it's going to undermine core values. It just completely replicates, which undermine core values, but ignoring how core values are completely undermined by current structures of delivery of services. But we're going to say, but if you do this, the implication, you'll do more. And I was completely struck doing talking at the International Legal Ethics, and I discovered I was really in favor of this. And the more I looked at it, England is doing it, really interesting models. I had several people I didn't expect. One guy says, you drank the Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
That's
fascinating.
And I understand that what I need to do is, I went back and said, I've got to really tease out and be, I really tanked down my rhetoric to say, here are the concerns. Like, here's why, based on this, you know, 2 years of looking at this, think that concerns are overblown and the benefits are undervalued. And very much the community idea that I had gotten the theme that lawyers are trying to circle the wagon and say law belongs to us, and to say, you know what, how about if you envision it that the community of non-lawyers are also involved in that they can have core values too.
Yeah.
It's not that the only one, you know, that, so yeah. Expand the idea of who has core values.
Right.
So it's but that might be an example where it's not the language of religion,
right.
But it's replicated.
That's very
that's maybe a softer form.
And then the problem is, I mean, you know, what I've is that the prophets don't really want to listen to that because the mere fact that you're bringing the nuance in is a matter of betrayal. So I see it as a triangle, actually. I mean, this isn't in this book. I don't know where I'm going to put it. But basically, our normal form of discourse is deliberative discourse. You know, we deliberate. Well, sometimes deliberative discourse can degenerate, you know, because it's, you know, it becomes sophistry or it becomes casuistry in the bad sense. And so what prophecy does is shake you out of that and say, don't you realize these are members of the community too? It's meant to shake people out of false and distortive premises for practical reasoning. Then what gets rid of bad prophecy, though? You know, that's, you know, kind of the question. You know, you can't argue with a prophet because they don't take arguments. You know, they're not in, you can't out-prophesy a prophet. That just gets loud. But what you can do is make fun of a prophet. And one of the reasons, I think, why Stephen Colbert and John Stewart are so popular is because they've been the effective tool in diffusing the culture wars, because John Stewart just makes fun of them, and then at some point somebody has to come in and say, okay guys, we got to grow up now, we got to get back, we got to solve this problem, let's get back to work, and then you go back to the circle of deliberative.
But there's a cost to that too. It didn't work out too well for Socrates when he got made fun of. He's still,
no.
It can have the
you're right.
You making fun can actually erode that what the person's doing. There may be, it may throw out the baby with the bathwater.
Oh yeah, no. All of these forms of rhetoric have good uses and distortions. They've all got a worrisome side.
We have a couple more hands up. Yeah, yonder.
So I really appreciate your emphasis on the prophets. Focus on these fundamental matters. It seems like a way of defining prophecy that goes well with what we see in ancient practice, where prophets are recognized or they play roles within the institution. You know, it's a hereditary and sort of a professional office. Political advisors are often what they seem to be. But I have a question about the way that you're using the category of prophet. How do you identify a prophet? And is a prophet aware that they're speaking as a prophet? Or is this a label that's put on outside, you know, from others who are analyzing the rhetoric? And you regularly are returning to a specific type of rhetoric and seem to be identifying prophets on the basis of the types of speeches that they make. So that suggests that they're not necessarily aware of their prophetic status.
I guess I need to make this very clear. I'm not talking about anybody who's been called by God or who is functionally in the role of a prophet. I'm talking about prophetic rhetoric. And anybody can use prophetic rhetoric to talk about anything. And normal people can make a choice to talk about abortion or torture in one way or another way. So I'm not using prophet as a label for a person. It's a shorthand way of describing the way a particular person is talking at a particular point in time. So I'm not interested in people with defined roles. I'm interested in the use of rhetoric that's modeled to some degree on what happened, on the literature, on scriptural models, but isn't pulling in all of the social roles. So it's a type, I'm analyzing rhetoric, not roles, is the shorthand answer.
We're drawing close to the end here, so we have one or two more hands if we can get a couple more questions. We have about 10 minutes.
Just real briefly, I'm wondering about the romanticization of the prophet in some circles. You know, I think in religious discourse, for example, one of the highest compliments we can give to somebody is saying they're a prophetic figure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I remember seeing a post recently on a particular listserv commending somebody for their courageous and prophetic stance, and I couldn't help think of the irony of the fact that this person was articulating a view that everybody in the audience agreed with.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, we've kind of redefined prophetic and courageous to mean thank you for affirming what I believe to be true. So I'm just wondering, well, no, and I think we do that a lot.
Point.
And so we just give that label to you, and by implication, by the way, to me as well, because I agree with you on this. And so I don't know if that's a modern phenomenon, but I mean, I do think in sort of the culture wars lingo, we use this word in a highly romanticized way. I don't know whether there's evidence of that going back to the biblical tradition, after the fact maybe, but I'm just curious about how that complexifies talking about this kind of rhetoric.
Yeah, well, what I'm trying to do is pull that out, you know, I mean, to just say, let's look at how it operates rhetorically and not use it as a term of opprobrium on the one hand or a term of praise on the other. And, you know, and really trying to get people to say, I mean, I've, as I said, I've gotten yelled at by people who say, well, you're talking about prophetic language by people who are not good people. For me, prophets always are good people. And I'm like, well, I'm what I'm trying to look at is, you know, is Aristotle forensic versus deliberative? Matthew Arnold, who talks about the rhetoric of sweetness and light versus the Hebraic rhetoric of fire and strength. And, you know, so this goes back to the, you know, criticism in, you know, well into the, you know, into the 19th century and earlier. I wonder if the language of prophet, at least in recent times, I mean, I think the problem for more progressive people is that they, you know, the prophets were, you know, Martin Luther King and the Berrigans and the anti-war movement, and then all of a sudden they've gotten themselves faced with, you know, the Family Research Council and the and you know, Robbie George and Richard John Newhouse, and, you know, and are you going to use the language for them? And if you're going to use it normatively, some people wouldn't. But I want to say, well, you know, the language is very similar. And
Robbie George gave a lecture here under the title of Prophetic Voices in America.
That's right. I invited him. That's right. We don't use it romantically. We mean it. Yeah. David, did you have the last question? Was there someone else who hasn't spoken yet?
Oh, if somebody else wanted to go, that's okay.
Okay, why don't you bring us home?
I mean, one of the things that's sort of interesting to me in terms of when we get into issues like the abortion debate and gay marriage and so forth, in the Roman Catholic tradition, the claims that those things are unacceptable are grounded largely on natural law argument, which is supposed to be demonstrable by reason, which is supposed to be achieved deliberatively.
Yes.
So, I mean, the interesting question is, how does this prophetic strand fit together with the natural law theory that it's deliberation and reason that gets you to where you're going?
That's fascinating. I think that that's a very important point. And you can tell that prophetic rhetoric had kind of like overcome in America when Catholics started using it, because fundamentally we were the whore of Babylon, so we were the ones that it was used against in Puritan times. And you're right, it's very inconsistent. But what happened, I think, is John Paul II's culture of life, culture of death, which was not meant to describe two warring political parties, got merged with James Davidson Hunter's The Culture Wars and used by certain Republican operatives. So it became a kind of team sport and fit into the broader Manichaean framework. So, cult, you know, so the example of this is, you know, contraception and humanae vitae, you know, it was a hard question, a remote application of the principles of natural law about which reasonable people could disagree, you know, and the different bishops, the German bishops, the Canadian bishops said, well, you know, we said this, but you don't really need to follow it. And then JP2 comes in and contraception gets reframed from being a hard question of natural law to being what I call the gateway drug to the culture of death. You know, I mean, and that's, you know, that's how it's functioning right now in American political thought. It is, you know, it's not
but
just
it's inconsistent to try to make that kind of move from this very black and white to this very carefully articulated notion of the role of reason.
Ought doesn't imply can, maybe, but it doesn't imply cannot either, you know, and I agree with you 100%.
Okay, thanks.
Well, this has been terrific. Thank you all for your contributions
to
the conversation, and thank you especially to Professor Cave.
Thank you.